And to reiterate that Chief Justice Stiglitz could not be present with us here today, but she is listening to the arguments and will be participating in these decisions. So we are now, we have a group of cases that are on for argument next. So we have case number 84958, State versus Bratton, 85150, State versus Burns, 85399 and 85400, State versus Gonzalez, and 85516 and 85517, State versus Flores. So I see we have Ms. Kate ready to go. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I would. Thank you, Justice Kadish. I would like to reserve 5 minutes.
Okay. You know how the clock works. Watch your own time. Go ahead.
May it please the court. My name is Marilee Kate. I represent the state of Nevada in these consolidated appeals today. And the state is urging this court to reverse the district court orders imposing the extreme and excessive sanction of dismissal, and for several reasons. First, there's not a statutory basis that the district court relied on to dismiss these cases, not a Nevada statute on point that provides for dismissal under these circumstances. Second, there is not any persuasive or binding precedent, particularly binding precedent by this court, that provides for dismissal under these circumstances. The district court didn't consider this court's opinion in Morgan, which does address transportation delays, and also sets forth that the Babian standard applies for dismissals for due process violations. The district court in three of the orders, in Burns, Flores, and Gonzalez, did cite Babian, didn't cite Morgan, but did cite Babian, but found, contrary to what Morgan held, the district court found that the delay here created aggravated circumstances, relying on a federal consent decree that isn't in place any longer.
But counsel, don't you think that the consent decree gives us a good benchmark for how long is reasonable to do transports?
Thank you, Justice Bell. I appreciate that question. So the federal consent decree, I have a couple responses to that I'd like to make. First, the federal consent decree was based on Mink's finding of the 7-day reasonable period of time. That actually comes out of, if you look at Mink, I think it's footnote 13, discusses that is specific to Oregon law, the 7-day time period, is why that was reasonable in the Mink case. But if we assume, because in Burnside they did, that the 7-day is the time frame that we should rely on, in Morgan, this court said that we couldn't rely, non-parties could not rely on that federal consent decree to create the aggravated circumstances in a criminal case to warrant dismissal. But
so
also,
how many days should somebody sit in jail with nothing happening in their case before dismissal is an appropriate remedy?
So I think, you know, on the far side, you look at Jackson, which is this United States Supreme Court approved over 3.5 years and sent the case back to the district court, where there wasn't a finding in the record of a substantial likelihood to regain, to go make that finding. So certainly approving of more than 3.5 years. Now, I'm not here to say that the delays that are happening here are a positive thing. I think everybody is frustrated by what's happening here, but I do want to go back to a point you raised about Burnside, because in Burnside, even the federal district court and the parties recognized that they couldn't just order Lakes Crossing, Stein was created through Burnside, but they couldn't order Lakes Crossing to just start transporting within 7 days. They actually, in Burnside, gave from December 22nd, 2015 to April 1st, that's 105 days, for Lakes Crossing to reduce just the Clark County wait list, which was 24 people. So that's 105 days of recognizing that, okay, Lakes Crossing needs to do some things before we can start pushing forward the 7-day time frame for reasonableness. And so I appreciate that what we're working with here is kind of around that time frame in a lot of these cases. It's in Bratton, 117 days, and Burns was something like 78. In Flores, around 117, 112 days, too. And then in Gonzalez, it was 159 days until he was actually transported. He was transported. And so we're certainly looking at, these are long delays. I'm not here to say that they're not. But the state's position is that these delays under either Nevada authority or persuasive authority are not warranting dismissal.
So what is the remedy here? If it's not dismissal, what is it, or is there no remedy?
Well, certainly I think these civil cases represent that there's the most systemic change is going to come from civil litigation, a civil injunction, either federal or state, you know, pursuing the state due process clause and pursuing an injunctive relief, where then we can actually create change, because that's what happened in Burnside, right? We didn't have the Stein facility before Burnside was, before litigants got together and sued the state. So that's certainly one remedy, but I think another remedy is for these courts to consider, and I think it's case by case, so the courts have to really look at this, but the district court could consider whether bail is appropriate, reconsider a bail determination.
Is that ever requested here?
That has not been requested.
On any of the four gentlemen's cases?
No, defense counsel did not request bail in any of these cases that I'm aware of. The district court could also consider whether maybe ordering outpatient treatment, its findings on whether the individual is dangerous, whether inpatient is required, because what you're seeing in a lot of these evaluations is that the evaluators are saying, certainly inpatient treatment is recommended. It's going to be the most helpful, and you can understand that if you're trying to impose medication, you're trying to stabilize an individual. But in any of these records, I haven't seen one where it's absolutely required. But I think that's an option to the district court too. Consider, can we consider an outpatient treatment in certain circumstances, so somebody's not lingering in jail? You could consider, I think a couple of district courts have decided that haven't dismissed, have held kind of walked it through, held a lot of status conferences, making sure there's progress toward that goal and what that progress looks like from Lakes Crossing. Are they still completely full? Is the sheriff still ready to transport? Are all the medical clearances ready so that the second that that individual is up, he can be moved to Lakes
That's
Crossing?
That's not happening with the systemic problem here. It's contempt. Is that inappropriate? Is that, and again, the releasing, you still have to make a finding that they're not a danger to themselves or to others. And in a lot of these cases, they can't make that finding.
Right. And I certainly think that for outpatient, absolutely, that dangerousness. And in these cases, we do have victim crimes. We have pretty serious crimes. So I don't know that the outpatient option that I was suggesting would be necessarily appropriate for these ones. But I agree with Your Honor, Justice Perry-Gary, that, you know, and a couple courts have considered whether contempt is appropriate, but then the courts have found that contempt wasn't appropriate because there's no ill will on the part of Lakes. But then they've jumped to this remedy, this most extreme remedy of dismissal. And that's where the problem is that the district courts are essentially creating this new rule for dismissals in criminal cases, which says that there's we find a constitutional violation, you go automatic to dismissal. And that's just not consistent with this court's or any other court that we could find.
Ms. Kate, let me ask you this, because in a criminal prosecution like this, you're from the Washoe County District Attorney's Office, and you say you're appearing for the state, which is statute provides that you prosecute on behalf of the state. But do you represent the state agency that governs Lakes?
I appreciate this question. And no, Your Honor, I do not. I do not represent the state agency that governs Lakes. And I think,
do we need them to be part of the case, or are they part of the case?
So it was really interesting in two of the cases, actually, in Burnside and Gonzalez, the district court kind of took an order to show cause approach to review and then ordered the state to secure the presence of counsel for Lakes and the Washoe County Sheriff's representatives. So we did in those cases bring somebody in, but it was in a unique scenario, right? They weren't a party to the case. And so it was interesting. The state obviously cooperated with the district court's order. We're going to bring them in. We're going to make the record. But no, we don't represent that. And I think that's part of, I think, and I understand the district court's frustration. The state's frustrated. right? We want to pursue these cases. If somebody can be attained competency, we want to be able to get them there and prosecute those offenders and let them have their opportunity for a trial. But the problem that we have is the district court is expressing this frustration with policy of the legislature. Long-term funding was discussed. The district court said, you know, this is a call to the legislature in Flores. In Gonzalez and Burnside, the district court discussed the, you know, decades of legislative policy. But it's the state, the Washington County District Attorney's Office, the prosecutor, isn't responsible for those policies. And so in every other dismissal scenario, the court looks at law enforcement did something, you know, to tip the scales of justice that's going to impact the merits of a case. You know, that's when we're talking about dismissal. Law enforcement's doing something that they shouldn't be doing. The prosecutor's doing something that they shouldn't be doing. And it's at, not just shouldn't be doing, but it's so aggressive that it's going to taint the merits of the case. It's going to cause prejudice at the trial.
Well, but right? I mean, each of these individual defendants has constitutional rights to due process, and to hold them indefinitely with no end in sight, and this agency apparently couldn't answer as to when they would be transported. At some point, something's got to happen, and throwing up your hands and saying, sorry, we don't have enough space, isn't an answer.
Well, I would disagree that the record supports that they're indefinitely confined. In Burns, at one of the hearings, in Bratton, at page 87 of the record, the Ms. Melee represented that 14 to 30 days would be transport in that case. So again, not indefinite. In Burns, there had been progress made. There wasn't a specific timeline, but he had moved up the list. And so at the dismissal hearing, he was number 11 Washoe County, 25 statewide, but had made progress. In Flores, which the hearing occurred around the same time as the Burns hearing, Burns was August 8th, 2022. Flores was August 25th. On August 25th in Flores, Ms. Melee testified that Mr. Flores was 15th on the Washoe County list, and that he would be admitted in 8 weeks as an estimate. In Gonzalez, yeah, we know
8 weeks is not a good answer.
I absolutely understand.
For a moment. A moment ago, you said the district courts that haven't dismissed the cases. Are there, so other than Judges Walker and Simons, are the other judges not dismissing the cases in the second? And if so, this process where they're setting status checks and doing hearings, is it leading to progress, or what's happening?
Yes. Okay. Thank you so much for the question. I was looking through my records of what we filed appeals on, and we have a couple pending right now. Department 6 and Department 7, so Judge Walker, Judge Simons, are the primary judges that are dismissing the cases. I did recently hear that there's another judge that has dismissed, but I haven't seen that record yet. So I don't know the basis, if it's a similar basis of this general due process argument. Okay. But what they are doing, I think they are considering the contempt. A lot of them are saying that, you know, yes, this is terrible. Yes, we want things to change, but you are making progress on the record. Ms. Maley is coming in to say, you know, they're at this stage, or the state's reporting that they're at the stage they're making progress. And they are, my understanding is now, I think we hit the pinnacle, I'm hoping, of kind of when this was all happening. Ms. Maley testified that the worst kind of point was starting in December of 2021. And these cases were kind of around that time frame, that going through August of last year. But it seems like now we're in the 2 to 4 month range. Again, I'm not saying that that's great, but I think that it doesn't necessarily result in dismissal that time frame. And so some of the other courts are recognizing that, are considering Morgan, are considering Burnside, Babian, as a dismissal standard. And that is the standard that this court has set forth for dismissals for due process violations in criminal cases. And the district courts here, just in these cases that we have in front of you, aren't applying those standards that are set forth. They've kind of created a new standard for, we find a constitutional violation, automatic dismissal. And that's not consistent with this court's precedent. I would like to, unless this court has any more questions for me now, I'd like to reserve the remaining of my time.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Katie Reynolds for on behalf of the Washoe County Public Defenders and the consolidated respondents in these cases. And I think what the real heart of this case comes down to, and it's a fundamental disagreement between the state and the defense about what constitutes outrageous or aggravated circumstances such to the point that dismissal is appropriate. And to start and to look at the Burnside order that came up just previously, I think a second question would be is it outrageous that the state will only comply with its constitutional obligations when it's under a consent decree? Should that have to be the standard to obtain a consent decree to get the state of Nevada to comply with its constitutional obligations? The state in its briefing has pointed to the fact that there's no bad faith conduct here. You can't point to any one actor in this system, and the defense is generally in agreement. There is nobody maliciously refusing to transport these people for treatment. What instead you have is a system of justice that is utterly inadequate and ill-equipped, it appears, to comply with the very dictates of our Constitution. If you look at previous holdings of this court, in Maynard v. Nault, we've said that substantive due process, it concerns the adequacy, not of the prosecution's reason, but the adequacy of the government's reason, the reason for depriving a person of life, liberty, or property.
Ms. Reynolds, though, can we talk a little bit about the remedy? Because it doesn't seem like dismissal really gets to the heart of the problem here, right? How does, just as a system, this move the ball forward? It's just one less person that Lakes or Stein has to take if the case gets dismissed.
And I think that goes to the fact that there are two. There's a greater system-wide problem here. And then there is the very real personal problem, or the real person-by-person problem, that you have somebody who's being deprived of their due process rights, who's being held. If you look at somebody when they've been found to be incompetent, first of all, under NRS 178-430, bail is exonerated. So you no longer have the option of bailing out. Your case has been stayed under the provisions of 178-400.
But did you all ask for any type of release on behalf of your clients based upon the inability to transport them for treatment?
Reviewing the records in these cases, the requested remedy was dismissal at this point. And I think,
so that, just to be clear, that would be no. Nobody asked for any kind of release or movement to outpatient. They just went straight to requesting the dismissal.
At this point in the proceedings, yes, once these people have been found to be incompetent.
Okay.
And again, at that point, they have been committed to Lakes. Legally, you can't, when you're incompetent, you can't demand a speedy trial. You can't plead. You have no legal right. So you are in a situation where in Washoe County right now, if you are mentally ill and you are accused of a crime, you are looking at an automatic multiple-month jail sentence just by virtue of those two things. That does not comport with our Constitution. And the state, in its notice of supplemental authorities, actually provided a fairly recent Ninth Circuit opinion. It's in United States v. Donnelly. And some of that case does go in favor of the state. What happened in Donnelly is that a defendant was committed. There were transportation delays. A motion to dismiss was filed at about, I think it was the 4-month point. By the time this case came in front of the Ninth Circuit, the defendant had been confined awaiting transport for mental health treatment for about 8 months. So in that case, the Ninth Circuit did find, absolutely, that's a due process violation. It just is. And then the state cited it for the proposition that in crafting an appropriate remedy, what the Ninth Circuit did was examine the possibilities and said that an injunction or that an order, a transport order, that the defendant be transported within 7 days was the appropriate remedy in this case. But what I find really compelling is what the court said in the last paragraph of its opinion. And what they said was, we note in closing that nothing in our decision today forecloses the possibility the dismissal may become appropriate at a future date, either in this case or in others like it. Other defendants may be able to show that the government's unreasonable delay amounts to the kind of flagrant misconduct warranting dismissal. And should the Attorney General fail to comply with the district court's order, and that's that order to transport within 7 days on remand, this court or that court may consider whether such a failure, layered on top of the existing violations, leaves available no lesser remedial action than dismissal.
So let me ask you this, and these, it sounds like a very remedial question, but what is the due process violation here, in your words?
The due process violation is the deprivation of liberty, and under Jackson, that somebody is being held indefinitely, or if somebody is incompetent and being held indefinitely without treatment towards competency.
Okay. And then what's the aggravating circumstances? And you can pick any one of these gentlemen's cases. What's the aggravating circumstances?
I would actually, looking then at Donnelly, I would draw the court's attention to State versus Flores. In that case, Mr. Flores was found incompetent on April 28th. An order remanding him to Lakes was entered on April 30th. There was a status hearing on June 16th, no transport. There was a status hearing on August 18th, still no transport. At that hearing and after that hearing, on August 19th, the court issued a second remand order to Lakes. And in that order, much like contemplated in Donnelly, they ordered that Mr. Flores be transported within 7 days. The parties returned to court on August 31st, so 12 days later. Mr. Flores had not been transported. And not only that, but the division had also indicated that it was going to be unable to comply with the requirements of NRS 178-450 that they submit within 6 months of the initial remand order, a report, again, addressing the ability of Mr. Flores to regain competency. So I think especially looking at Flores, you've got the failure to comply with multiple court orders. You have the fact that he was at approximately over 4 months, had not been transported. And I think that is exactly the kind of case that Donnelly contemplates, that it's within the discretion of the district court to dismiss.
So your point is that the amount of time is the aggravating circumstance? And I want to be fair to you. That this is part of my concern about the court's rulings in the cases. For Gonzalez, for instance, the court says the denial of his due process rights for restorative treatment, which resulted in a 160-day delay, creates aggravated circumstances. Same thing in Flores. Denial of restorative treatment is a substantive due process violation and constitutes aggravated circumstances. My concern is the court is conflating these things or intertwining them together rather than saying we have a due process violation, which is the inability to transport for treatment. And then what are the aggravating circumstances, i.e. why is that conduct occurring? Is there something that's going on separate from the denial of the ability to transport itself? And it doesn't seem to me that the court has examined or identified anything here that constitutes aggravating circumstances beyond the due process violation itself.
And I think, first of all, if you look at NRS 178-450, that's what gives the six-month deadline to submit the report. I would be incredibly reluctant when we're talking about number of days confined to put any real beyond the 7 days that Mink and True Blood and some of those civil litigation cases imply is reasonable. I think anything over 7 days begins to be an issue and a due process violation. With respect to can the amount of time alone be enough to be aggravating circumstances? I think in some cases, yes. I think in other cases, you can look and see if there were other aggravators. And that's why in Flores, I think that failure to comply with the second remand order, that's showing that the court at that point has ordered once that they be transported with the general transport order, reasonable time. And then when that didn't happen for multiple months and the court issued the second order, transport within 7 days.
But the issue hadn't changed since 7 days, right? The transport was not occurring regardless of how many court orders there were because of the inability and bed space to transport somebody. So we're really just reiterating the same thing over and over again. My point was there something in the government's conduct beyond just we can't transport because we don't have bed space that would aggravate this particular due process violation, like was discussed, I think, at least in Morgan and Bedia?
I think, first of all, I think Babayan at least dealt with prosecutorial misconduct, and that's a different sphere.
Sure.
With respect to Morgan, I think that's procedurally different insofar as in Morgan, the district court had ordered transported within 7 days, and he was.
Right.
And then when it came for review to this court, it was on appeal. He had been restored to competency, and there had been a trial. That's a different procedural setup.
Ms. Reynolds, my only concern really, I think this is clearly a due process violation. I don't think anyone's contesting that. It is by dismissing the case, we let these people out into the world with no mental health care. How do we reconcile that? I mean, these people committed or allegedly committed, crimes, and they're suffering from some mental issues, which I think should definitely be addressed. But if we dismiss it, how are they going to get the help that they need to kind of maybe not reoffend?
And I think there are several different options. There's first, the state always has the option under NRS 433 A200 to seek standard civil commitment. And then there is also the option within the statutory scheme itself of the competency statutes that for certain category A for all category A and then certain enumerated category B felonies, it's NRS 178-461A. Those are that the state actually can seek that if a proceeding is dismissed because a defendant is incompetent and unlikely to regain, which the district court's orders alluded to that, I believe, in the orders themselves. So when a case is dismissed on those grounds, the state has the ability to seek a commitment order for up to 10 years under that statute. So
I think my understanding is that the court didn't dismiss on those grounds. It was more of a 14th Amendment kind of,
I think in Gonzalez and Flores, the state dismissed based on all of them, the court referenced due process. I think Gonzalez and Flores, the state referenced both the statute and primarily due process. I think this court has the power to say that the district court reached the right result, wrong reasons. And I think there is some authority to do that. If you look at Washington v. Kidder, it was cited in some of our briefing, and Kidder was a Washington case. And that is where the Washington statute is a little bit different than Nevada, but it requires essentially a 90-day commitment and then an application for renewal at the end of the 90 days.
We don't have a finding in any of these cases that these individuals could not be restored to competency, do we?
That is true. And that's why what happened in Kidder is that at the 90-day mark, the defendant still had not been transported, was still in the county jail. The court in that case said that because there was no new evaluation, that she was incompetent and unlikely to regain based on the inaction of the state, and therefore dismissed under the statutory ground. So that would be the dismissal under 178-425. And I think this court, again, would have the power as an alternate to the due process violation to look at these cases and say that that is the appropriate ground. And then what that does do is that gives those statutory safeguards. So there is then the 10-day period within which for the state for, again, those certain under the 461 sub-provision where somebody has been accused of a serious crime, is possibly dangerous to society, then the state can seek that commitment order.
So let me ask you that again, just to follow up. You say seek civil commitment. What does that look like? What they just sit there in jail? If you don't have the facilities and the bed space and staff, and you're seeking a civil commitment as opposed to the criminal proceedings, what does that look like?
And I am not entirely sure how the state would handle that in these cases. I would note that it was, there was no petition filed in these cases.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you. Under 178.461, though, that isn't really a entirely civil commitment, right? Because the person is at least initially in a secured forensic facility. They either go to Lakes or Stein unless there's some other plan developed by Lakes or Stein down the road, as opposed to the 433A civil, just a straight civil commitment.
And that is why I suspect that the state did not file this petition. And again, I can't know the state's motivations for filing or not filing something, but that is very possibly why that was not sought in these cases, because it might be that Lakes does not have the capacity to handle those, which again, then gets into what is the ultimate due process violation in these cases generally, which is that you cannot simply warehouse people at the jail without rights.
So if I could interrupt again. So I saw, at least in Bratton, there was, although it was a motion to dismiss, the court issued an order to show cause, but ultimately found that neither the Washoe County Sheriff's Office nor the Washoe County District Attorney's Office was acting in contempt of court. And I understand those findings by the court, and that seems to be why the court moved on from considering contempt to the remedy it chose. But my question to you is, could the court in these cases impose a contempt sanction, not against the Washoe County DA or the Washoe County Sheriff, but against the state agency responsible for providing this treatment?
I think it would be within the power of the district court to do so. I think, provided again that Lakes would need to be named a party and given notice of the proceedings and represented by counsel. I am not sure to what end it would, what end there would be. And this is speaking from experience in other cases. I know that occasionally when Lakes has been named, that a party will be transported before the hearing. I think there are limits to how much movement you can get using that as a sanction. I think it's possible. I think the bottom.
So how could they be made a party to the criminal case, state versus X, Y, or Z?
And I suppose they wouldn't be named a party, but I think they would have to be given notice and ordered to appear.
Certainly, they're entitled to due process also.
Yes, exactly.
What do we achieve by the dismissal here? I mean, when we think about, for instance, prosecutorial misconduct and dismissal as a sanction, we're trying to curb prosecutorial misconduct. When the courts create exclusionary rules for evidence, we're trying to curb law enforcement misconduct. What is being achieved by dismissing these cases? We're not going to curb Lakes Crossing having its beds full and being able to do anything, right? I mean, maybe hopefully if all the cases are being dismissed, the legislature acts in some fashion to fund mental health in a better way than they have. But in your mind, what are we achieving?
I think on one end, you are putting the executive branch, and I say that generally, the state of Nevada, the executive branch of the government, and that's part of what substantive due process stands for, is that you can't have different parts of the executive branch pointing fingers at each other and saying that it's their fault, it's not our fault. And so the dismissal at a certain point is, if you want to say a wake-up call, or the buck stops here, that this has to be figured out, because then that's the other half of dismissal, which is that it takes these people who are being incarcerated, who are currently innocent, and who are not receiving treatment of competency, whose due process rights have been violated, and it releases them into the community. I don't think
it's which we could accomplish by asking the courts to consider that before dismissing the case, right?
I'm sorry.
Your point being that the dismissal releases them from custody, that's a remedy that would be available if you asked the court for that based on the delays prior to the motion to dismiss, right?
It's possibly a remedy that would be considered. It was not asked for here, but again, I think statutorily.
I guess I have a question here, though. You're supporting these dismissals with the argument that this is a due process violation, but to what extent does the theoretical availability of other remedies short of the sort of DEFCON 1 affect the due process analysis? I think it's part of what Justice Herndon's getting at, which is you have the failure to transport as the due process violation, but then analyzing next to dismissal, if there are other remedies that have not been availed, for example, getting the right parties before the court to address this in a curative way, does that affect what we do here as the judiciary?
I think the answer to that is in Donnelly and in all of the cases involving abuse of discretion, that really a lot of those remedies are within the discretion of the district court. I think Donnelly stands for the proposition that the district court can consider what has been done, can take lesser action, but ultimately does have the power to dismiss. And I would then look at the Flores case here specifically, where the district court did do some of those steps that were set forth in Donnelly and then dismissed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask just one final question?
Sure, go ahead.
When you have these cases, and it seems like the state to some degree has awarded these people that can't make their own decisions and have no rights to speedy trial, you had referred to that. But when you've got these people who've, the experts have said they're a danger to themselves, they're a danger to society, they're a danger to themselves, and the cases are going to be dismissed. And we all know that. The treatment folks know that. The prosecutor, the defense counsel knows this individual's a danger to himself. How do you process that? We had a case years ago, the Butler case, going back to 2005 or 6. I don't know if you're familiar with
that. I am.
Yeah, and you know, it was released under circumstances that caused him to have injury to himself. How do you process that?
I think Mr. Butler was looking at the obligation of the state to not negligently release someone from prison.
Right.
I think at a certain point, you cannot hold somebody incarcerated indefinitely. And the district court, if you look at each of these cases when dismissing, that weighed heavily against the district court. It's a factor to consider. It's always something to consider. Mm-hmm. Civil commitment remains. Incarcerating somebody not whose case has been stayed just for the sake of incarceration, who's not receiving treatment, that's a due process violation under Jackson.
So you just convert it again. I'm trying to get back to the civil commitment. And I don't mean to pester you on this, but that's where I'm kind of stuck. If they're civilly committed, nothing is going to happen either because Lakes Crossing, and systemically, they can't handle these cases. So dismissal, you dismiss them to the street. A civil commitment in the sense that they're still sitting in jail, not being transported anywhere for treatment. That's where it's just bombs.
I would note that in several of these cases, these people had deteriorated significantly at the jail, and that at least on the street, there are, for those people who avail themselves of them, social service programs and some resources and some treatment. It might not be ideal, but it's there.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Kate.
So I'd like to begin where kind of Justice Perry and Gary, you kind of left off, and making a point that Ms. Mele made, which is this isn't serving the dismissal here, and several other, Justice Bell, Justice Lee, you inquired on this too, but this isn't serving these defendants. And what Ms. Maley said in Flores when she was talking about that, that 7-day order, so we just can't comply with that because it's unsafe. And she said, she noted that, that at least in jail, the individual is secure, even though that's not the best scenario. He's not being treated. I'm certainly not asserting that that's a great situation, but she said, you know, at least they're in a secure environment.
We don't hold mentally ill people in jail because they're mentally ill. And that's what's really happening here, right?
I agree. We do not hold them specifically, but, and that's what Jackson was concerned about, right? Because in that case, it was specific that that individual was mentally ill and he was just being held. Here, we also have the findings of dangerousness.
The state did have the option to ask to civilly commit them, not to Lakes or Stein, but to the I don't know what the hospital is in Washoe County, but to the hospital where people would go if they were not charged with a crime, right?
So what's difficult, and one of the records, and I want to say it was in Flores, where Ms. Maley test it, where there was some examination about, well, what other options do we have? The district court, I think, inquired, Judge Simons was asking, well, could we convert these civil facilities to help this situation? But those civil facilities are full. And actually, Ms. Maley, kind of across the cases, testified about the increase in civil commitments in the last 5 years as part of the problem that has created the difficulty in restorative treatment, because we've increased the civil commitments, the long-term 10-year type commitments.
No. So I think that there's a little bit of confusion. So we have the long-term statutory commitments for people who have been charged with a category A or B offense, right? They can be held up to 10 years and they have to be held in at least initially in a forensic facility like Stein or Lakes Crossing. But there's also the option to civilly commit through the regular civil commitment process, where you're completely outside of that Lakes or Stein hospital process. They go to the local, in Clark County, it's Ross and Neal. They go to that hospital and then they are treated until they have attained competence and then released. So was that done with any of these cases?
No, because, well, the only person who was even, Gonzalez was actually transferred. But no, the state didn't do that in any of these cases. The state chose to pursue an appeal, arguing that dismissal was an improper remedy in these cases. We didn't choose to hold them longer. I mean, we understand, again, it's difficult because we understand the due process argument that's being made. We understand the frustration of the courts. We don't receive any benefit, as I've already argued, to this kind of the delay that's happening here. But I did want to touch on, because I did raise it and then it was discussed by my colleague, the Donnelly case. So I think this court should take, you know, if you are going to look at Donnelly, take a very careful reading of that. What the Ninth Circuit actually did, that was it came out of Oregon. There's a 240-day delay, you know, 8 months, approximately 240 days. The court really focused there on the United States code violation. It says that that treatment can't exceed 4 months, which is different than Nevada statute. But even there, the court said the 8 months, so double what their statute provides or their code provides, doesn't result in dismissal in that case. Then in the footnote, which is what I focused on in my notice, was that it said, okay, even assuming due process, it did not find due process. It assumed, of course, based on Trueblood and Meek, that yes, their due process had been violated, but it said, even assuming due process had been violated, that the remedy isn't dismissal. And then it did when it referred.
Well, but what is the remedy? What are you saying is the remedy here?
In these cases, I'm sorry.
Representing the state, and what do you say is the appropriate remedy?
Well, certainly representing the district attorney's office. I think that we've kind of touched on some of them. There are civil remedies. I mean, I certainly think there are civil remedies that are most useful that would at least address these concerns
more
holistically. But
isn't that part of the state's obligation to seek those out?
So the Washoe County District Attorney's Office suing the state, suing the Division of Mental Health? I mean, I think we could, but I think in other litigation, it's all been through the defendants have pursued those remedies I think, you know, you could consider some form of contempt of Lakes, although it's difficult because you can't find that there was a bad action, right? Lakes isn't purposely delayed. Right?
But they're not fulfilling their constitutional obligations. I had a question, though, about the remedy of release, right? Because to hold somebody inpatient for an inpatient restoration, the court already has to make a finding that they're a danger to themselves or others. So doesn't that make release a problematic solution?
So, I mean, I think, so I'm aware of a couple of district courts that have done that, who have kind of reevaluated based on the facts and circumstances. I don't think under these other cases that we have right now before you, I don't know that that is the right remedy, Justice Bell, of releasing specifically, I mean, certainly Gonzalez, the sex assault case, that was a unknown victim to the defendant. I mean, you know, but I think that it does kind of go to kind of the larger concept, and I'm about out of time, but it really, there's the releasal or the dismissal doesn't serve these defendants either. It doesn't serve the community. It doesn't serve anybody. I mean, no one in the criminal justice system is receiving some benefit because of this delay. It is unfortunate. But at the same time, and I know I'm at the end, can I just conclude?
Yes.
Okay.
And then I'm going to ask you another question anyway. So go ahead.
I was just going to say that in other constitutional violations, you know, the district court has really created this new rule here, as I've already said. But in other constitutional violations, if a state isn't a bad actor, if we're not doing something improper, putting our fingers on the scales, dismissal isn't the remedy.
So my other question, and I guess part of the frustration, certainly for me, and if I can sort of read in and maybe sort of attribute it to the district judges, is we had this consent decree in place for 5 years that required transport in 7 days. And for those 5 years, going through the end of 2020, they complied with the consent decree. And then as soon as it expires, then we're back to, oh, sorry, we just can't transport. Why were they able to do it during the 5 years the consent decree was in place, but not now?
So, and I really appreciate this question because this was something that I was wondering about too. First, Burnside does say it only applies to Clark County. It did say it doesn't apply to res judicata or collateral estoppel for right. later cases.
Yes.
But I think holistically, what the record shows in each of these cases is Ms. Nele testified that in 2019, she had 7 staff members doing these evaluations. In 2020, she still had 6. By August of 2022, she had 2. So it's not that she also testified that at the beginning of COVID, like I think every case we heard earlier in a civil context, you know, things were shut down, things weren't happening as quickly. So she's testified that in the first 8 months, in the first several months, there was a decrease in orders, even though broadly speaking over the years, the increase has been 300% or something in these orders. But she said at the beginning, like everything, everything stopped and the orders weren't coming. But then as they started increasing, she was grappling with losing her staff. And now in 2021, as she said it December 2021, it really hit that peak of now she had 2 staff members doing these things still at that same time. They were the Lakes was still doing the Washoe County initial comp evals with those 2 staff members. And so then, you know, I think that's not great, but she talked about the problems of hiring in private practice. I think we all can recognize that even in the legal field, but in private practice, you're apt to make more money, and she's having a hard time recruiting people to fill these spots. But she had done national recruitment and different things. And by August, the last hearing transcript we have of her, they had gotten another part-time person. So they had 2 full-time, 2 part-time people. You know, they were making progress. It's slow. It's frustrating. You know, as I've said, we're frustrated as well. But you'd argue. Oh,
can I ask?
Go ahead.
Just out of curiosity, prior to COVID in Washoe County, were transports occurring within 7 months?
This issue hasn't been raised in Washoe County. I don't know for certain that it was exactly 7 days. I mean, she certainly did say, and even still, you know, they're occurring in the order that they're received. But we had the most significant, in August, we had 143 people on the wait list, 100 of those from Clark County, and, you know, 13 from rurals, 27-ish from Washoe. I mean, it got significant, but I think it's a combination of factors that kind of created this situation and that they are working through it. And so in conclusion, again, I would just ask that this court reverse the orders of the district court imposing that extreme measure of dismissal.
Thank you. Thank you both very much for these arguments today. And with that, we will stand in recess until the next call.